Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Petswood, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. And I'd like to invite you along to attend one of our services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Again, I'd like to thank you for your prayers and for your financial support of Lutheran Radio. For without your prayers, without your generous contributions, we would not be able to continue our ministry. And so we are deeply grateful to you for your support. Again, we'd encourage you to check out all of our past episodes. You can go to our podcast area and you can do a search and find interesting topics that are topics that may interest you. And again, encourage you to do that. Today, we are going to begin a conversation with Dr. Robert Rosine. Dr. Rosine is Professor Emeritus of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Bob is here at Westfield House doing some teaching for us at our House of Theological Studies, and we are very grateful to have him back with us. And we are going to talk about, over the next few weeks, some very special books that Luther wrote. We are on the 500th anniversary of three of Luther's most famous writings, and so we've asked Bob if we could talk about those today and over the next few weeks. So, Dr. Rosine, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
We mentioned that there are some very famous writings in the 1520s, but could you perhaps give us some historical background about what makes these so special and why they're viewed as such watershed moments in Luther's career?
Well, the three treatises, the appeal to the Christian nobility, then the Babylonian captivity of the church, sometimes called the pagan servitude of the church, and last, the freedom of the Christian. Those three are kind of watershed treatises. They come at a time when tension has been growing, when Luther has been getting more and more attention, and there's also been more and more criticism of him. Some people who had been fans increasingly now distance themselves from Luther, and when these three treatises come out in 1520, there are some who just say, that's it, that's too much, and they back away. Now, who are the some? They are people we call humanists. Humanists in the 16th century are not the same as 20th century or now 21st century. Secular humanists, where man is the center of attention, human being is the center of all things. And in fact, from the first humanist manifesto, Bertrand Russell days, to the second, we went from suggesting man is by himself or the human beings are by themselves to there is no God. That's certainly not the case in the 16th century. Humanism is peopled by scholars who are all Christians. They will differ. Some stay within the Roman Church. Others go the direction of the Reformation. But none of them are apart from the notion of God and Christ and salvation. They will argue and debate over how that needs to be understood best. And humanism actually gave them material to talk about. Humanism is a revival of the liberal arts. It was around in classical antiquity. People talked about how one learned or how one dissected learning through grammar, through logic, and through rhetoric, three ways of reading or understanding speeches. Then once you got your communication ability and skills down, you turned to subject matter. The basics were mathematics, geometry, which is math sort of spatially applied. Then they talked about astronomy. That was kind of code for all the sciences, the heavens and everything below. And finally, music, which was, again, kind of a code word for the fine arts that were there. Those four areas were then explored by means of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Well, that worked fine in classical antiquity. When the Roman Empire collapses, when hard times come, education also falls by the wayside all too often. Humanist, or classical rather, antiquity goes into eclipse. We talk about the Dark Ages. That's not a very nice term. But the fact of the matter is, in the early part of the Middle Ages, people were worried about keeping nose above water. And they don't have time for what we would like to do with education. Well, the things are still around, kind of on the books, but not paid much attention to. Charlemagne in the 9th century tried to revive them and use schools to link his very disparate empire. That's a kind of nice episode, but then they again slide. In the 12th century, Aristotle from classical antiquity is rediscovered. The texts of Aristotle had been found and interpreted by Muslim commentators after the Muslim conquests, and their work in turn was translated into Latin, found its way into the West, and suddenly the little bit of Aristotle became a lot of Aristotle, including his posterior analytics, for example, that is to say his writings on logic and thinking. Aristotle made much of syllogistic logic, if, therefore. And Aristotle's logic was taken into the church, was used along with his vocabulary as a way to categorize theology. We talk about, within the Roman church, transubstantiation. One substance, the essence of a thing, is changed to another, while the accidents, the characteristics of bread and wine, remain. It's supposed to be transferred or transubstantiated into body and blood of Christ. All that vocabulary and talk is borrowed from Aristotle. The church found it a convenient way of making sense of things and organizing. Well, it becomes not simply a way, but the way. Scholastics at the universities use Aristotle and only Aristotle, and the liberal arts are not really allowed into the curriculum, unless you're going to argue everything logically. Well, that kills the subject right there. In the middle of the 14th century, we enter a different phase of scholastic theology, and about the same time, humanism begins to emerge. It's quite an accident. It's a long story we don't have time for. But it amounts to finding old languages, old texts from antiquity. Their ideas are resurrected. They look at things like poetry, the affective side of human nature, quite different from logic. And rhetoric becomes a bit more poetic. You wind up persuading people instead of arguing them logically into a corner. And the liberal arts of classical antiquity are revived. And new attention is paid to these in education. The thing is that scholastics don't want to make room at the university, so they close ranks, and humanists are kind of left squeezed out. Well, to fast forward, Wittenberg was founded in 1502. It is the last, or second last, there's one more that still comes in Frankfurt on the Oder River, off, it used to be the old East German border, or it is still the German border, Frankfurt, between Poland today and the eastern part of Germany. Wittenberg was founded in 1502. It was assumed, people thought, it would be another scholastic university. But Frederick the Wise, the founder of the school, decided that he would try to attract students of another sort. To get them to come to a place like Wittenberg, you've got to have a draw. And until the football team gets really good, you know, even to rival something like Nebraska and the Huskers, not to mention anybody in particular for Pastor Ehlers, you're going to have to do something else. And humanism, Frederick thought, would be the key. So in the charter, at the very end, he allows poesy and the arts, to be part of the curriculum, poetry and the rest of the liberal arts. Wittenberg then begins as a kind of free-for-all. There are scholastics who come and want to teach at the university. They want to bring the logic, but they're humanists. See, they've been squeezed out before. Now they're allowed inside the door, and they want to make use of this. It's a kind of a free-for-all the first decade or so. Luther shows up 1511 to finish his theological degree and stays on in 1512 to teach. He had found humanist tools useful to understanding the scriptures. The languages, Greek, he learned by 1508, taught himself Hebrew in 1509. That's always depressing for seminary students that Luther taught himself Hebrew. And then he goes and looks at the ancient texts. He finds church fathers who write commentaries on some of these books of the Bible or preach on them. However, as Luther went on in the 15-teens, more and more of the humanists, particularly the older folks, became somewhat nervous of Luther. He privately expressed his doubts about Erasmus, the prince of the humanists, with Erasmus's understanding of Romans. Erasmus had said you're freed from the ceremonial and civil law, when that's what Paul is talking about, but not the moral law. You still have to keep that as part of your efforts toward salvation. And Luther said, look, the grammar and the language, the texts say otherwise. They say free, and free means free. Well, he let that be known, and Erasmus then started to have his antenna up for about Luther, just to make sure Luther didn't stray too far. Privately, that little tension grew. Publicly, humanists worried about things like the 95 Theses. You know, is that too impertinent, really, to talk to the Pope that way? Or they worried about the Heidelberg Theses, where Luther said there is no such thing as free will. Well, a lot of humanists had been influenced by classical Neoplatonism, where God puts you in a circumstance, gives you a challenge, and then says, all right, what are you going to do? Rise, or are you going to plunge? And freedom for them meant neutrality. Luther and Erasmus would later clash over that. Erasmus would argue that point. Luther would say, no, free means godly. You're not left to yourself. You couldn't possibly do things by yourself. So the humanists are concerned about the direction in which his theology is leading. When he says at Leipzig, popes and councils can and have erred, that bothers them really a lot. What about authority? And they're really starting to kind of take one step back. Then comes 1520 and these writings. And they read what Luther writes and they say, that's too much. He's just really trashed the church. Authority is gone. Respect for the priesthood is gone. People are turned loose in a kind of life of liberty, really not just liberty, but license. So we're going to look at each of these three just briefly. The first of these is his appeal to the Christian nobility. Luther had hoped that by preaching about the gospel and having it set forth, that the bishops and others would see the light of day, would see the problems of the Roman Church and see the problem that the Pope stood for, and make a move and start to bring reform. But it's not happening. Luther had hoped it would just automatically kind of follow as the gospel got out in front of people, but it didn't. In fact, even as the decade in the 1520s wore on, Luther became more and more discouraged, because less and less did it seem as though people were going to actually vote with their feet and go an evangelical way. I mean, many people did, but church officials often not. You know, you have to understand them. They're vested in this. This is a world they grew up in. Their thinking's been shaped a certain way, and you don't just automatically kind of get up, turn your back, and walk away from it. Well, if bishops are not going to promote the Reformation, then who would? It's the appeal to the Christian nobles of the German nation. Luther writes to princes. Well, princes, do they have a right to do this? You do indeed, says Luther. Luther says in his writing, Rome has thrown up three walls to try and stop reform. The first wall is the idea that there are sacred and secular vocations. Those who are in secular vocations, and princes fall on that side, should keep their hands off. The matter of theology and church, matters of salvation and eternity, those are done by sacred vocations instead. And while bishops might be able to protect the church, they have no right to say anything. There is a second wall that only the Pope can interpret scripture, and the third is that only a Pope can call a council. We'll come back to those other two, but let's go back to the first. Sacred versus secular vocation. Luther says this is rubbish, that if you look, in fact, at history, there were times before the church was even hierarchically developed as an institution, but other people still lived in daily life. And there are times also when kings and princes have had to step in and to aid the church. They're not pretending to be clerics. They're not saying we're part of the pastoral ministry or anything. No, that's not true. But they have a responsibility. See, because a prince is a father figure. His people are his children, so to speak, and a father ought to provide the best for the children. So if the bishops, who really do have the responsibility, if they drop the ball and fail to promote reform, then the prince has to step in and has to do it. Once things are righted, then others back in the church can pick up and carry on. When I say the prince steps in to do it, I don't mean, and Luther did not mean, that the prince is preaching, but he provides for right preaching from those who do know the gospel and are willing to put it out in front of the people. If you need an example, Luther said, this is not something new. This is something that's old and historical. And he's right. 500 years earlier, there had been, ever since then, there have been struggles between the Holy Roman Emperor and the papacy over who's really the patron of the church within the empire. Rome, of course, claims the authority. The emperor would say, yes, but it's my responsibility as, again, a kind of father figure, as the leader. These are my people. I need to provide the best for them. It's an argument that never really does get settled. They would argue over who has the greater authority, one over the other, and the papacy would say, well, this is church business, eternal business, and the emperor would say, yes, but it's our soil, our people. You're there from afar. If someone were to want a kind of biblical example, they'd say, well, you know, is there any kind of precedent? All you have to do is look in the Old Testament. David and Solomon are kings. They're not Levites. And yet David leads the people in celebration, for example, when the Ark of the Covenant is returned to Israel. See, he doesn't say, oh, well, that's clerics doing and just sort of sit there. He is an embodiment of Israel, as it were, and so he steps in rightly. Same thing here. Popes have to, if they're going to drop the ball, if they're not going to press the bishops to do the right thing, they're going to have to expect that monarchs will do it instead. So that's the first wall. It's not a permanent wall, not a permanent position. It's temporary. Say, fix it and then turn things back over to those who should preach the gospel. Second wall, only popes can interpret scripture. Luther looks at this and said, this is also nonsense. Look at the Bible. Look at the way people talked and studied and read. He points to the Corinthians about how they gathered around the scriptures. They sometimes got things wrong. That's why it's best to have several people involved. Luther's not real keen always on an individual by himself reading the Bible. I mean, he's not against Bible reading, but see, the problem is one person by himself can think of almost anything in his mind, and soon his imagination runs wild and he's off on who knows what for an interpretation. Put several people together, and Luther thinks the scriptures are plain enough so that people will catch each other. If one person is saying something and it's not quite right, and another one comes up and comes along and says, no, but think of this, and cites some verses, and think of that. The first one, Luther says, should be quiet and listen to the word being explained by somebody else. But see, those are not clerics doing that. That's the people doing it. They have the perfect right to read the scripture. And Luther says, they even have the right to tell those who are on the so-called secular side of the wall, which really doesn't exist, which has been torn down, that they're in error. So that's the second. The third area is that only popes can call a council. Now, Luther is hardly a new person to this argument. There were people in the Middle Ages who argued that councils, church councils, could be called by anybody. William of Ockham, a 14th century an English cleric, said at one point, any washwoman can call a council. In other words, if the people see a problem, they can say so, and they can ask for the church to assemble and to address it. Now, no one's saying that the washwoman is going to necessarily preside at the council, but she has a perfect right as a Christian to speak up and to say something. So Luther's argument isn't necessarily new here. It's something Rome has heard before. And they're prepared to try to refute it. But Luther says, look, it makes no sense. Here you have a pope who claims all authority for himself, total power, and then look what he does with it. He doesn't allow the gospel. He does bad things, not good things. Would God allow his church to fall into the hands of someone who has all authority and all power and then does evil? No, says Luther, which means there must be some others who can call him to account, who can set things on a right path. It's not up to papacy alone. So those are the three walls, sacred, secular, there is no distinction. Anyone who acts in faith does a good thing for God, does a good work, leads a good life. And princes, have the right to step in. Notice how conservative that is. See, Luther's not saying, oh, the people rise up and change the church. No, princes are the next person that this falls to. That's their responsibility as a leader. Well, you've got the prince, you've got the scriptures are open to all people. Luther says that they are priests. They have the right to read and to approach God. And when it comes then time to address problems in the church, this is not simply something the Pope has locked up and has total control of. It's something that belongs to the church. The church ought to take care of itself. It ought to address its own problems. But for many people looking from the outside, you see, that's a real problem. Luther had said popes and councils can err. Do you trust a council? Well, Luther didn't think you necessarily even had to have a council. People themselves could just simply gravitate to the right thing and do the right thing. He would later say, we don't really, when the council was offered to try and sort of blunt the Reformation, Luther simply said, well, we've had our council. The people have voted with their feet. In other words, they've walked over to the evangelical, to the Lutheran churches, and that's our council. It's a radical position. And the older humanists who had been supportive of Luther see this, and it makes them very, very nervous. It won't be the last thing that makes them nervous. This is just the start of it. In 1520, these three treatises were published. They come in alphabetical order, except they didn't speak English. But for us, it's a help. The Appeal to the Christian Nobility, A, and then the Babylonian Captivity of the Church will come next, B, and then F, the Freedom of the Christian. They're all crammed into the last couple months of the year in 1520. Luther, actually, for what it's worth, has already been condemned by Rome, or it's in the process. In the summer, the Pope had issued a papal bull, Exsurge Domine, Arise, O Lord, a wild boar, B-O-A-R, is loose in the vineyard. In other words, it's trampling down the grapes and destroying everything, so do something about it. That happened in the summer. Once that is promulgated, then it has to be properly filed with authorities. Today it would all go electronically, and in a nanosecond it would all be there. But see, somebody has to bring this from Rome up to the imperial authorities and to Frederick the Wise, who's sheltering Luther, giving him sort of cover to do these things. And after the paperwork is filed, then Luther will have 60 days. Well, the 60 days ran out in December, which means it was filed back in October. These treatises start in November. So, It's you know, Luther knows already that the handwriting, so to speak, is on the wall. He might as well have at it and might as well make plain his ideas. You know, who knows how much longer they will let him speak. And so he does in something like this, in the Appeal to the Christian Nobility. If you turn this over to the nation, to the Germans, to the princes, and even to the emperor, you know, who could stop a reform at that point? That's what Luther's hoping for. And once it goes, and once people see it, they will call upon their priests to do the right thing. And the priests and the bishops can hardly then stand by and ignore it. The people will see the truth in the scriptures and have at it. So, yeah, that's kind of the first of the three treatises.
Dr. Bob Rosin, we thank you for introducing us to the Appeal to the Christian Nobility, the first, as you say, of these three very famous and watershed treatises. Also, thank you for mentioning the great University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and I appreciate that. We invite our listeners back next week to join us as we continue our conversation on these three documents, as we'll be looking at the Babylonian captivity next week. So thanks again, Dr. Rosin.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.